content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the year 2020 and the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll read a short story by David Sedaris, an article about aliens and the interstellar object Oumuamua, and an article about preparing for climate change. I'll begin today with a short story from the December 29, 2003 edition of the New Yorker magazine by David Sedaris, Let It Snow. Winters were frustratingly mild in North Carolina, but the year I was in the fifth grade, we got lucky. Snow fell, and for the first time in years, it accumulated. School was canceled, and 2 days later, we got lucky again. There were 8 inches on the ground, and rather than melting, it froze. On the fifth day of our vacation, my mother had a little breakdown. Our presence had disrupted the secret life she led while we were at school, and when she could no longer take it, she threw us out. It wasn't a gentle request, but something closer to an eviction. "Get the hell out of my house," she said. We reminded her that it was our house, too, and she opened the front door, shoved us into the carport, and shouted, "And stay out!" My sisters and I went down the hill and sledded with other children from the neighborhood. A few hours later, we returned home, surprised to find that the door was locked. "Oh, come on," we said. I rang the bell, and when no one answered, we went to the window and saw our mother in the kitchen, watching television. Normally, she waited until 5 o'clock to have a drink, but for the past few days, she'd been making an exception. Drinking didn't count if you followed a glass of wine with a cup of coffee, and so she had a goblet and a mug positioned before her on the countertop. "Hey," we yelled, "open the door, it's us!" We knocked on the pane, and without looking in our direction, she refilled her goblet and left the room. "That bitch," my sister Lisa said. We pounded again and again, and when our mother failed to answer, we went back around and threw snowballs at her bedroom window. "You're going to be in so much trouble when Dad gets home," we shouted, and in response, my mother pulled the drapes. Dusk approached, and as it grew colder, it occurred to us that we could possibly die. It happened, surely. Selfish mothers wanted the house to themselves, and their children were discovered years later, frozen like mastodons in blocks of ice. My sister Gretchen suggested that we call our father, but none of us knew his number, and he probably wouldn't have done anything anyway. He'd gone to work specifically to escape our mother, and between the weather and her mood, it could be hours or even days before he returned home. "One of us should get hit by a car," I said. "That would teach the both of them." I pictured Gretchen, her life hanging by a thread, as my parents paced the halls of Rex Hospital, wishing they had been more attentive. It was really the perfect solution. With her out of the way, the rest of us would be more valuable and have a bit more room to spread out. "Gretchen, go lie in the street." "Make Amy do it," she said. Amy, in turn, pushed it off on Tiffany, who was the youngest and had no concept of death. "It's like sleeping," we told her, "only you get a canopy bed." Poor Tiffany. She'd do just about anything in return for a little affection. All you had to do was call her Tiff, and whatever you wanted was yours. Her allowance, her dinner, the contents of her Easter basket. Her eagerness to please was absolute and naked. When we asked her to lie in the middle of the street, her only question was, "Where?" We chose a quiet dip between two hills, a spot where drivers were almost required to skid out of control. She took her place, this 6-year-old in a butter-colored coat, and we gathered on the curb to watch. The first car to come along belonged to a neighbor, a fellow Yankee who had outfitted his tires with chains and stopped a few feet from our sister's body. "Is that a person?" he asked. Well, sort of, Lisa said. She'd explained that we'd been locked out of our house, and while the man appeared to accept it as a reasonable explanation, I'm pretty sure he was the one who told on us. Another car passed, and then we saw our mother, this puffy figure awkwardly negotiating the crest of the hill. She did not own a pair of pants, and her legs were buried to the calf in snow. We wanted to send her home, to kick her out of nature just as she had kicked us out of the house. But it was hard to stay angry at someone that pitiful looking. "Are you wearing your loafers?" Lisa asked, and in response, our mother raised a bare foot. "I was wearing loafers," she said. "I mean, really, it was there a second ago." This was how things went. One moment she was locking us out of our own house, and the next we were rooting around in the snow, looking for her left shoe. "Oh, forget about it," she said. "It'll turn up in a few days." Gretchen fitted her cap over my mother's foot. Lisa secured it with her scarf. And surrounding her tightly on all sides, we made our way home. And now, from the January 16, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I'll read an article entitled, "Have Aliens Found Us? A Harvard Astronomer on the Mysterious Interstellar Object, Oumuamua." A.V. Loeb, the chair of Harvard's astronomy department, believes that the peculiar nature of the interstellar object called Oumuamua raises questions about its possible origins. By Isaac Chotiner. On October 19, 2017, astronomers at the University of Hawaii spotted a strange object traveling through our solar system, which they later described as a red and extremely elongated asteroid. It was the first interstellar object to be detected within our solar system. The scientists named it Oumuamua, the Hawaiian word for a scout or messenger. The following October, Avi Lieb, the chair of Harvard's astronomy department, co-wrote a paper with a Harvard postdoctoral fellow, Shmuel Bialy, that examined Oumuamua's particular acceleration and suggested that the object may be a fully operational probe sent intentionally to Earth's vicinity by an alien civilization. Lieb has long been interested in the search for extraterrestrial life, and he recently made further headlines by suggesting that we might communicate with the civilization that sent the probe. "If these beings are peaceful, we could learn a lot from them," he told Der Spiegel magazine. I recently spoke by phone with Lieb, who was frustrated that scientists saw Oumuamua too late in its journey to photograph the object. "My motivation for writing the paper is to alert the community to pay a lot more attention to the next visitor," he told me. During our conversation, which has been edited and condensed for clarity, we discussed why Lieb thinks we need to consider the possibility that Oumuamua was sent by aliens, the dangers of unscientific speculation, and what belief in an advanced extraterrestrial civilization has in common with faith in God. Question 1. Your explanation of why Oumuamua might be an interstellar probe may be hard for lay people to understand. Why might this be the case, beyond the fact that lots of things are possible? Dr. Lieb, there is a Scientific American article I wrote where I summarized 6 strange facts about Oumuamua. The first one is that we didn't expect this object to exist in the first place. We see the solar system, and we can calculate at what rate it ejected rocks during its history. And if we assume all planetary systems around other stars are doing the same thing, we can figure out what the population of interstellar objects should be. That calculation results in a lot of possibilities, but the range is much less than needed to explain the discovery of Oumuamua. There's another peculiar fact about this object. When you look at all the stars in the vicinity of the sun, they move relative to the sun. The sun moves relative to them. But only one in 500 stars in that frame is moving as slow as Oumuamua. You would expect that most rocks would move roughly at the speed of the star they came from. If this object came from another star, that star would have to be very special. Well, what are some of the other strange facts? When it was discovered, we realized it spins every 8 hours, and its brightness changed by at least a factor of 10. The fact that its brightness varies by a factor of 10 as it spins means that it is at least 10 times longer than it is wide. We don't have a photo, but in all the artist's illustrations that you have seen on the web, it looks like a cigar. That's one possibility, but it's also possible that it's a pancake-like geometry, and, in fact, that is favored. Well, what would be the meaning of a pancake-like geometry? Wait, the most unusual fact about it is that it deviates from an orbit that is shaped purely by the gravitational force of the sun. Usually, in the case of comets, such a deviation is caused by the evaporation of ice on the surface of the comet, creating gases that push the comet, like the rocket effect. That's what comets show, a cometary tail of evaporated gas. We don't see a cometary tail here, but nevertheless, we see a deviation from the expected orbit. And that is the thing that triggered the paper. Once I realize that the object is moving differently than expected, then the question is, what gives it the extra push? And, by the way, after our paper appeared, another paper came out with analysis that showed very tight limits on any carbon-based molecules in the vicinity of this object. Oh, what is the significance of that? It means that there is no evidence of gas that relates to the evaporation of ice. We don't see the telltale signatures of cometary tail. Moreover, if it was cometary activity, then we would expect the spin period of this object to change. And we don't see that. All of these things are indicative of the fact that it is nothing like a comet that we have seen before in the solar system. And it is also nothing like an asteroid. Its brightness varies by a factor of 10, and the maximum you typically observe is a factor of 3. It has a much more extreme geometry, and there is some other force pushing it. The question is, what's providing this force? And that was the trigger for our paper. The only thing that came to my mind is that maybe the light from the sun, as it bounces off its surface, gives it an extra push. It's just like a wind bouncing off a sail on a sailboat. So we checked that out and found that you need the thickness of the object to be less than a millimeter in order for that to work. If it is indeed less than a millimeter thick, if it is pushed by the sunlight, then it may be a light sail. And I could not think of any natural process that would make a light sail. It is much more likely that it is being made by artificial means by a technological civilization. I should say, just as background, I do not view the possibility of a technological civilization as speculative for two reasons. The first is that we exist. And the second is that at least a quarter of the stars in the Milky Way galaxy have a planet like Earth, with surface conditions that are very similar to Earth, and the chemistry of life as we know it could develop. If you roll the dice so many times and there are tens of billions of stars in the Milky Way, it's quite likely we are not alone. So, this civilization would be out of the solar system and in the galaxy? In this galaxy. It may be dead by now because we don't take good care of our planet. Imagine another history in which the Nazis have a nuclear weapon and the Second World War ends differently. You can imagine a civilization that develops technology like that, which would lead to its own destruction. It's possible that the civilization is not alive anymore, but it did send out a spacecraft. We ourselves sent out Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. There could be a lot of equipment out there. The point is that this is the very first object we found from outside the solar system. It's very similar to when I walk on the beach with my daughter and look at the seashells that are swept ashore. Every now and then we find an object of artificial origin, and this could be a message in a bottle, and we should be open-minded. So we put this sentence in the paper. Okay, it's different, of course, but the way you said that reminded me of an argument I have heard for creationism, which is that if you find a watch on the beach, you know it must be man-made. And since our eyes are as complex as a watch, we must also be designed by a creator. Okay, an advanced technological civilization is a good approximation to God. Suppose you took a cell phone and showed it to a cave person. The cave person would say it was a nice rock. The cave person is used to rocks. So now imagine this object, Oumuamua, being the iPhone and us being the cave people. We look at it and say it's a rock. It's just an unusual rock. The point of this analogy is that for a cave person, the technologies we have today would have been magic. They would have been God-given. Corin Baylor Jones, an astronomer, quoted in one of the pieces in your paper, wrote, "In science, we must ask ourselves, where is the evidence? Not..." Exactly. Hold on. "Not where is the lack of evidence so I can fit in any hypothesis that I like." Baylor Jones of the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Heidelberg, Germany, has identified four possible home stars for Oumuamua and was asked to respond to Leib's light sail theory by NBC. Well, it's exactly the approach that I took. I approach this with a scientific mind, like I approach any other problem in astronomy or science that I work on. The point is that we follow the evidence. And the evidence in this particular case is that there are six peculiar facts. And one of these facts is that it deviated from an orbit shaped by gravity while not showing any of the telltale signs of cometary outgassing activity. So, we don't see the gas around it. We don't see the cometary tail. It has an extreme shape that we have never seen before in either asteroids or comets. We know that we couldn't detect any heat from it, and that it's much more shiny by a factor of 10 than any typical asteroid or comet. All of these are facts. I am following the facts. Last year, I wrote a paper about cosmology where there was an unusual result, which showed that perhaps the gas in the universe was much colder than we expected. And so we postulated that maybe dark matter has some property that makes the gas cooler. And nobody cares. Nobody is worried about it. No one says it's not science. Everyone says that it is mainstream to consider dark matter a substance we have never seen. That's completely fine. It doesn't bother anyone. But when you mention the possibility that there could be equipment out there that is coming from another civilization, which, to my mind, is much less speculative because we have already sent things into space ourselves, then that is regarded as unscientific. But we didn't just invent this thing out of thin air. The reason we were driven to put in that sentence was because of the evidence, because of the facts. If someone else has a better explanation, they should write a paper about it rather than just saying what you said. Okay, one of your responses to these criticisms was, "I follow the maxim of Sherlock Holmes. When you have excluded the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth." But when it comes to things we can't explain or don't understand, Don't we often turn to concepts that do exist in popular culture and society? No, 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 no. Let me give you a better example for that kind of argument you are making. The multiverse is a mainstream idea that anything that can happen will happen an infinite number of times. And I think that is not scientific because it cannot be tested. Whereas, the next time we see an object like this one, we can contemplate taking a photograph. My motivation, in part, is to motivate the scientific community to collect more data on the next object, rather than argue a priori that they know the answer. In the multiverse case, we have no way of testing it, and everyone is happy to say, "Yah!" Another mainstream idea is the extra dimension. You see that in string theory, which get a lot of good press and awards are given to the members of that community. Not only has it not been tested empirically for almost 40 years now, but there is no hope it will be tested in the next 40 years. And yet your friend has no problem with that. Whoever you are quoting has no problem with the multiverse, with string theory. No problem. Well, we don't know what the person, Corin Baylor Jones, thinks about these things, to be clear. He never complains about it. He never mentions it. I don't even know if it's a he, and I don't know his or her opinions. Okay, whoever. The point I was trying to make is that we live in a culture where people talk about aliens. No, but that's different. Hold on, let me finish. The term UFO in popular usage has basically come to mean aliens of some sort. My question is whether we tend to see things that we can't know or understand through the prism of things we have heard about since we were kids. Aren't we more likely to see something like an alien society as an explanation than something we maybe can't even comprehend or put into words? Oh, I don't enjoy science fiction because there are things in science fiction that violate the laws of physics. I like science and I like fiction, but separately. The main argument against any of the UFO stories that you may have heard about is that the technology of detection have improved dramatically over the past few decades. We have cameras that are far better than we used to have, and nevertheless, the evidence remains marginal. And so that is why there is no scientific credibility to UFOs. What we are talking about today is part of science. We have seen an object from outside the solar system, and we are trying to figure out what it is made of and where it came from. We don't have as much data as I would like. Given the data that we have, I am putting this on the table, and it bothers people to even think about that, just like it bothered the church in the days of Galileo to even think about the possibility that the Earth moves around the sun. Prejudiced is based on experience in the past. The problem is that it prevents you from making discoveries. If you put the probability at 0% of an object coming into the solar system, you would never find it. Okay, have your religious beliefs or beliefs about God changed in any way in the time you've been studying astronomy? I am not religious. Why do you make that assumption? I didn't. I was wondering if your thoughts had changed one way or the other. Okay, first of all, it depends on what you mean by God. But if you take something that is zero and multiply it by any number, it remains zero. I was secular to start with. I am not religious. I am struck by the order we find in the universe, by the regularity, by the existence of laws of nature. That is something I am always in awe of. How the laws of nature we find here on Earth seem to apply all the way out to the edge of the universe. That is quite remarkable. The universe could have been chaotic and very disorganized, but it obeys a set of laws much better than people obey a set of laws here. My work as a scientist is purely based on evidence and rational thinking. That's all. And now, from the September 8th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, what if we stopped pretending? The climate apocalypse is coming. To prepare for it, we need to admit that we can't prevent it. By Jonathan Franzen. There is infinite hope, Kafka tells us, only not for us. This is a fittingly mystical epigram from a writer whose characters strive for ostensibly reachable goals and tragically or amusingly never manage to get any closer to them. But it seems to me, in our rapidly darkening world, that the converse of Kafka's quip is equally true. There is no hope except for us. I'm talking, of course, about climate change. The struggle to rein in global carbon emissions and keep the planet from melting down has the feel of Kafka's fiction. The goal has been clear for 30 years, and despite earnest efforts, we've made essentially no progress toward reaching it. Today, the scientific evidence verges on irrefutable. If you're younger than 60, you have a good chance of witnessing the radical destabilization of life on Earth. Massive crop failures, apocalyptic fires, imploding economies, epic flooding, hundreds of millions of refugees fleeing regions made uninhabitable by extreme heat or permanent drought. If you're under 30, you're all but guaranteed to witness it. If you care about the planet and about the people and animals who live on it, there are two ways to think about this. You can keep on hoping that catastrophe is preventable and feel ever more frustrated or enraged by the world's inaction. Or you can accept that disaster is coming and begin to rethink what it means to have hope. Even at this late date, expressions of unrealistic hope continue to abound. Hardly a day seems to pass without my reading that it's time to roll up your sleeves and save the planet, that the problem of climate change can be solved if we summon the collective will. Although this message was probably still true in 1988, when the science became fully clear, we've emitted as much atmospheric carbon in the past 30 years as we did in the previous two centuries of industrializations. The facts have changed, but somehow the message stays the same. Psychologically, this denial makes sense. Despite the outrageous fact that I'll soon be dead forever, I live in the present and not the future. Given a choice between an alarming abstraction, death, and the reassuring evidence of my senses, breakfast, my mind prefers to focus on the latter. The planet, too, is still marvelously intact, still basically normal. Seasons changing, another election year coming, new comedies on Netflix, and its impending collapse is even harder to wrap my mind around than death. Other kinds of apocalypse, whether religious or thermonuclear or asteroidal, at least have the binary neatness of dying. One moment the world is there, the next moment it's gone forever. Climate apocalypse, by contrast, is messy. It will take the form of increasingly severe crises compounding chaotically until civilization begins to fray. Things will get very bad, but maybe not too soon. Maybe not for everyone. Maybe not for me. Some of the denial, however, is more willful. The evil of the Republican Party's position on climate science is well known, but denial is entrenched in progressive politics too, or at least in its rhetoric. The Green New Deal, the blueprint for some of the most substantial proposals put forth on the issue, is still framed as our last chance to avert catastrophe and save the planet by way of gargantuan renewable energy projects. Many of the groups that support those proposals deploy the language of stopping climate change or imply that there's still time to prevent it. Unlike the political right, the left prides itself on listening to climate scientists who do indeed allow that catastrophe is theoretically avertible. But not everyone seems to be listening carefully. The stress falls on the word theoretically. Our atmospheres and ocean can absorb only so much heat before climate change, intensified by various feedback loops, spins completely out of control. The consensus among scientists and policymakers is that we'll pass this point of no return if the global mean temperature rises by more than 2 degrees Celsius. Maybe a little more, but also maybe a little less. The IPCC, the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, tells us that to limit the rise to less than 2 degrees, we not only need to reverse the trend of the past 3 decades, we need to approach 0 net emissions globally in the next 3 decades. That is, to say the least, a tall order. It also assumes that you can trust the IPCC's calculations. New research, described last month in Scientific American, demonstrates that climate scientists, far from exaggerating the threat of climate change, have underestimated its pace and severity. To project the rise in global mean temperature, scientists rely on complicated atmospheric modeling. They take a host of variables and run them through supercomputers to generate, say, 10,000 different simulations for the coming century in order to make a best prediction of the rise in temperature. When a scientist predicts a rise of 2 degrees Celsius, she's merely naming a number about which she's very confident. The rise will be at least 2 degrees. The rise might, in fact, be far higher. As a non-scientist, I do my own kind of modeling. I run various future scenarios through my brain, apply the constraints of human psychology and political reality, take note of the relentless rise in global energy consumption. Thus far, the carbon savings provided by renewable energy have been more than offset by consumer demand, and count the scenarios in which collective action averts catastrophe. The scenarios, which I draw from the prescriptions of policymakers and activists, share certain necessary conditions. The first condition is that every one of the world's major polluting countries institute draconian conservation measures, shut down much of its energy and transportation infrastructure, and completely retool its economy. According to a recent paper in Nature, the carbon emissions from existing global infrastructure, if operated through its normal lifetime, will exceed our entire emissions allowance, the further gigatons of carbon that can be released without crossing the threshold of catastrophe. This estimate does not include the thousands of new energy and transportation projects already planned or under construction. To stay within that allowance, a top-down intervention needs to happen not only in every country, but throughout every country. Making New York City a green utopia will not avail if Texans keep pumping oil and driving pickup trucks. The actions taken by these countries must also be the right ones. Vast sums of government money must be spent without wasting it and without lining the wrong pockets. Here it's useful to recall the Kafkaesque joke of the European Union's biofuel mandate, which served to accelerate the deforestation of Indonesia for palm oil plantations, and the American subsidy of ethanol fuel, which turned out to benefit no one but corn farmers. Finally, overwhelming numbers of human beings, including millions of government-hating Americans, need to accept high taxes and severe curtailment of their familiar lifestyles without revolting. They must accept the reality of climate change and have faith in the extreme measures taken to combat it. They can't dismiss news they dislike as fake. They can't dismiss news they dislike as fake. They have to set aside nationalism and class and racial resentments. They have to make sacrifices for distant threatened nations and distant future generations. They have to be permanently terrified by hotter summers and more frequent natural disasters rather than just getting used to them. Every day, instead of thinking about breakfast, they have to think about death. Call me a pessimist or call me a humanist, but I don't see human nature fundamentally changing anytime soon. I can run 10,000 scenarios through my model, and in not one of them do I see the 2-degree target being met. To judge from recent opinion polls, which show that a majority of Americans, many of them Republican, are pessimistic about the planet's future, and from the success of a book like David Wallace Wells' Harrowing the Uninhabitable Earth, which was released this year, I'm not alone in having reached this conclusion. But there continues to be a reluctance to broadcast it. Some climate activists argue that if we publicly admit that the problem can't be solved, it will discourage people from taking any ameliorative action at all. This seems to me not only a patronizing calculation, but an ineffectual one, given how little progress we have to show for it to date. The activists who make it remind me of the religious leaders who fear that, without the promise of eternal salvation, people won't bother to behave well. In my experience, non-believers are no less loving of their neighbors than believers. And so I wonder what might happen if instead of denying reality, we told ourselves the truth. First of all, even if we can no longer hope to be saved from 2 degrees of warming, there's still a strong practical and ethical case for reducing carbon emissions. In the long run, it probably makes no difference how badly we overshoot 2 degrees. Once the point of no return is passed, the world will become self-transforming. In the shorter term, however, half measures are better than no measures. Halfway cutting our emissions would make the immediate effects of warming somewhat less severe, and it would somewhat postpone the point of no return. The most terrifying thing about climate change is the speed at which it's advancing, the almost monthly shattering of temperature records. If collective action resulted in just one fewer devastating hurricane, just a few extra years of relative stability, it would be a goal worth pursuing. In fact, it would be worth pursuing even if it had no effect at all. To fail to conserve a finite resource when conservation measures are available, to needlessly add carbon to the atmosphere when we know very well what carbon is doing to it, is simply wrong. Although the actions of one individual have zero effect on the climate, this doesn't mean that they're meaningless. Each of us has an ethical choice to make. During the Protestant Reformation, when end times was merely an idea, not the horribly concrete thing it is today, a key doctrinal question was whether you should perform good works because it will get you into heaven, or whether you should perform them simply because they're good. Because while heaven is a question mark, you know that this world would be a better place if everyone performed them. I can respect the planet and care about the people with whom I share it without believing that it will save me. More than that, a false hope of salvation can be actively harmful. If you persist in believing that catastrophe can be averted, you commit yourself to tackling a problem so immense that it needs to be everyone's overriding priority forever. One result, weirdly, is a kind of a complacency. By voting for green candidates, riding a bicycle to work, avoiding air travel, you might feel that you've done everything you can for the only thing worth doing. Whereas, if you accept the reality that the planet will soon overheat to the point of threatening civilization, there's a whole lot more you should be doing. Our resources are not infinite. Even if we invest much of them in a longest shot gamble, reducing carbon emissions in the hope that it will save us, it's unwise to invest all of them. every $1 billion spent on high-speed trains, which may or may not be suitable for North America, is $1 billion not banked for disaster preparedness, reparations to inundated countries, or future humanitarian relief. Every renewable energy mega project that destroys a living ecosystem, the green energy development now occurring in Kenya's national parks, the giant hydroelectric projects in Brazil, the construction of solar farms in open spaces rather than in settled areas, erodes the resilience of a natural world already fighting for its life. Soil and water depletion, overuse of pesticides, the devastation of world fisheries. Collective will is needed for these problems, too. And unlike the problem of carbon, they're within our power to solve. As a bonus, many low-tech conservation actions, restoring forests, preserving grasslands, eating less meat, can reduce our carbon footprint as effectively as massive industrial changes. All-out war on climate change made sense only as long as it was winnable. Once you accept that we've lost it, other kinds of actions take on greater meaning. Preparing for fires and floods and refugees is a directly pertinent example. But the impending catastrophe heightens the urgency of almost any world-improving action. In times of increasing chaos, people seek protection in tribalism and armed force rather than in the rule of law. And our best defense against this kind of dystopia is to maintain functioning democracies, functioning legal systems, functioning communities. In this respect, any movement toward a more just and civil society can now be considered a meaningful climate action. Securing fair elections is a climate action. Combating extreme wealth inequality is a climate action. Shutting down the hate machines on social media is a climate action. Instituting humane immigration policy, advocating for racial and gender equality, promoting respect for laws and their enforcement, supporting a free and independent press, ridding the country of assault weapons, these are all meaningful climate actions. To survive rising temperatures, every system, whether of the natural world or the human world, will need to be as strong and healthy as we can make it. And then there's the matter of hope. If your hope for the future depends on a wildly optimistic scenario, what will you do 10 years from now when the scenario becomes unworkable, even in theory? Give up on the planet entirely? To borrow from the advice of financial planners, I might suggest a more balanced portfolio of hopes, some of them longer term, most of them shorter. It's fine to struggle against the constraints of human nature, hoping to mitigate the worst of what's to come. But it's just as important to fight smaller, more local battles that you have some realistic hope of winning. Keep doing the right thing for the planet, yes, but also keep trying to save what you love specifically, a community, an institution, a wild place, a species that's in trouble. And take heart in your small successes. Any good thing you do now is arguably a hedge against the hotter future. But the really meaningful thing is that it's good today. As long as you have something to love, you have something to hope for. In Santa Cruz, where I live, there's an organization called the Homeless Garden Project. On a small working farm at the west end of town, it offers employment, training, support, and a sense of community to members of the city's homeless population. It can't solve the problem of homelessness, but it's been changing lives one at a time for nearly 30 years. Supporting itself in part by selling organic produce, it contributes more broadly to a revolution in how we think about people in need, the land we depend on, and the natural world around us. In the summer, as a member of its CSA program, I enjoy its kale and strawberries. And in the fall, because the soil is alive and uncontaminated, small migratory birds find sustenance in its furrows. There may come a time, sooner than any of us likes to think, when the systems of industrial agriculture and global trade break down and homeless people outnumber people with homes. At that point, traditional local farming and strong communities will no longer just be liberal buzzwords. Kindness to neighbors and respect for the land, nurturing healthy soil, wisely managing water, caring for pollinators will be essential in a crisis and in whatever society survives it. A project like the Homeless Garden offers me the hope that the future, while undoubtedly worse than the present, might also, in some ways, be better. Most of all, though, it gives me hope for today. And now, from the December 30th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the Talk of the Town section, Lost and Found Department, an essay entitled Flew the Coop by Katya Bochko. The squawking started in the summer. By late fall, it would become the soundtrack to a tale of urban do-gooding gone awry. One morning in July, Kate Boycourt was frying plantains in her apartment in Ditmas Park when a peculiar sound caught her ear. She looked out her fifth-story window and saw a snowy white bird perched on her fire escape. 10 inches tall, with a pink blush around its beak, and an impish mohawk. The bird peered at Boycourt with a hungry stare. It was like he was saying, "I'm here in time for breakfast," Boycourt recalled the other day. Boycourt, who is 35 and works for the nonprofit Waterfront Alliance, is used to seeing pigeons and seagulls in her leafy neighborhood. But this specimen was new. The bird began appearing every day, and she started feeding it fruits and nuts. She turned to the Ditmas Park Facebook group, hoping to locate the bird's owner, and saw that neighbors had been filing field reports about the bird. Information trickled in slowly. The bird was known in the neighborhood because its owners used to put its cage on the porch of the Victorian house from time to time. It was a Goffin's cockatoo. It was a he. His name was Clyde. Clyde had a mate named Bonnie, who had also flown the coop. The owners, Ethan Clark, who was a stonemason, and his wife, Nicole, are not on Facebook, so they didn't see any of the updates about their bird. Occasionally, neighbors would tell them that Clyde had been spotted, and the Clarks would go searching for him without success. They did not feel comfortable knocking on the doors of strangers in the apartment buildings that Clyde frequented. Clyde's habit was to arrive at Boycourt's window between 5 and 6 a.m., and one day, as she put his breakfast on her fire escape, she saw that her downstairs neighbor, Sheila Kim, had left food out, too. So had Candace the Bartolo on 3 and Anya Ribensom on 2. The women began comparing notes on Clyde, sharing his likes, chili peppers, and dislikes, strawberries. "He seemed like the perfect pet," Boycourt said. "We were enamored with his freedom." As the weather turned chilly, delight turned to concern. But the four neighbors continued troubleshooting without tracking down the Clarks. "We're going to have a popsicle with feathers," Bartolo said. After a cold night, she ordered a fly fishing net. Clyde was too fast for her. DeBartolo's contacted someone at the Long Island Parrot Society, who recommended limiting Clyde's food source to one person and gradually moving the food farther inside. DeBartolo and Kim both have cats, and Ribensom already had a bird, so the task fell to Boycourt. The amateur bird catchers scoured the Internet. They watched a YouTube video called Hack Life, Creative Best Bird Trap Make from Big Cardboard Box That Works 100%, in which a boy recommended using rubber bands to fashion a spring-loaded pigeon snare. DiBartolo, a professional musician, noticed that Clyde came to the window when she practiced the flute part for Celine Dion's Because You Love Me, but flew away when she pulled out her saxophone. In November, with temperatures dipping into the 40s, the Cockatoo Committee called Bird Camp, an avian specialty store in Midtown, which put them in touch with Steve Carpenter, the owner of a female Goffin's cockatoo named Gracie. The next day, Carpenter, a burly IT consultant, arrived at Boycourt's apartment with Gracie. She had a blue tether fastened around her chest, and Carpenter gently placed her on the fire escape. Clyde arrived immediately. If everything had gone according to plan, Gracie would have hopped back inside and enticed Clyde to follow her. The two beach birds touched beaks and squawked amiably at each other for a few hours. But eventually Clyde flew off, and Carpenter took Gracie home. The rescuers were running out of options. Boycourt dreamed that she found Clyde dead on the fire escape. Her boyfriend ordered a chicken pen warmer, a kind of miniature space heater, which she planned to put outside the window. On the morning of November 8th, Boycourt rose early with a quiet resolve. Clyde was on the fire escape. As he ambled back and forth preening, Boycourt grabbed a purple bath towel. She threw it over the bird and pulled him into her apartment. "I felt like a ninja," she said. The creature bit her hard on the pinky. Boycourt thrust Clyde into a borrowed birdcage and texted her neighbors. "I caught him," she wrote. "He bit the heck out of me." Kim and DiBartolo raced upstairs to find droplets of blood on the floor. During the months of Clyde watching, the neighbors had come to the conclusion that the Clarks didn't care about getting their bird back. This was not the case. But Boycourt and the others took a finder's keeper stance. Instead of contacting the Clarks, the group called Glenn Serino, a bird expert whom the Times once called the Pied Piper of Parrots. He matched Clyde with a family of bird aficionados, the Molinas, on Long Island. They drove to pick up Clyde in Brooklyn, where a small party of neighbors gathered to say goodbye. "Maybe we can get him back for the summer," DiBartolo said. "He might be back even sooner." Not long ago, the Clarks, who had been worried for months, finally heard through the grapevine about Clyde's rescue, and they now hoped to bring him home. "I prayed Clyde would return safe," Nicole Clark said. "I saw a hawk plucking feathers off a pigeon recently." The December 30th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine is called the Cartoon Takeover Edition. And so, for the next few minutes, we will end the broadcast with some of the best cartoons from the New Yorker. In the first cartoon, a large number of people are standing in a field looking up into the sky at two suns. One man says to the other, "It looks as if our troubles are only beginning." In the next cartoon, we see a hall with a group of women, older women, all with hats and long dresses and dressed very nicely. It appears to be a book club. On the stage is a woman holding a book, and she says, "I shall now quote the passages which I consider obscene." In the next cartoon, a teenager is talking to her parents in the living room, and she says, "All I ask is a chance to ruin my life in my own way." The next cartoon depicts two large birds with large beaks sitting on a branch of a tree. One bird says to the other, "The Icarus story is just that, a story." In the next cartoon, we see a pigeon hovering in the, We see a penguin hovering in the air with his wings outstretched, hovering over an iceberg, and all the other penguins are looking up at the bird in the air. And he says, "We just haven't been flapping them hard enough." The next cartoon has a customs agent looking through the bag of a woman entering the country. She has her passport in her hand. Bag is open. Everything is all everywhere. And the custom agent says, "Why didn't you bring a cardigan or a lightweight jacket?" In the next cartoon, a pig is sitting on the examining table in a doctor's office. The doctor's standing next to him with a clipboard in his hand, stethoscope around his neck, white lab coat on. And the doctor says, "It's your ribs. I'm afraid they're delicious." And now we see, on the street corner, a hot dog salesman with his little hot dog truck. And he's giving a hot dog to a businessman in a business suit and a briefcase. And he says to the man, "They're marinated in hot water for 6 hours. The last cartoon depicts a herd of sheep grazing in a field. And there's a billboard in the field with a big picture of a wolf in a suit and tie. And the billboard says, "I'm going to eat you." And one sheep says to the other, "He tells it like it is." And I'll finish today's broadcast with a poem from the December 30th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine called "Thought for a Sunshiny Morning" by Dorothy Parker. "It cost me never a stab nor a squirm to trip by chance upon a worm. Aha, my little dear, I say, your clan will pay me back one day." Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.